afternoon. You are joining We the People Radio. My name is Erin Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
All the music comes from Bob. We appreciate it. I have kind of a challenge for you again today on the musical options.
I love a good challenge.
Okay, so for all those of you who followed our serial guest, Peter Friedman, if you followed those shows with him, where we talked about Islam and the Middle East, and I mean, we could have done 50 shows, but we did, I think, 5 right in a row. So he's our serial guest. The only other person we've had on that long was somebody who was on like three weeks, I think. So it's a huge topic. And the whole time during that show, he kept saying, you've got to talk to Frank Burley. He wrote this book. And he kept saying, it's in the book. It's in the book. I mean, that's like I know we always laugh. That's the answer to everything. It's in the book.
And I have to admit, I read the book.
He was completely not kidding.
And I could not put it down.
The book is called It's All About Muhammad. That's the name of the book. So that's what I called our show today, even though I should have called it This Is All the Stuff You Really Need to Know But Don't, because that's the truth.
Oh, it is. It is. I mean, it's about Muhammad, but it's about how the Quran was written, what's in the Quran, what and why these people believe what they believe.
From the very, very beginning.
From the very beginning.
It isn't just a bunch of people who now have gone off the rails and are, you know,
misinterpreting things.
Misinterpreting and setting off bombs.
Oh, no.
So I think you guys are going to be riveted. I've listed it all on the site. I guess I should give you some of that information. The website is wethepeopleradio.us. If you have friends, family, or anybody who's interested in this topic, if you go there, there's a distinct page with all the information about the book, and it'll have the archive of the show by 3:30 today, something like that. And so you can send that to friends and family. We have a commercial-free one. All the archive, the full archive, posted by about 2:15. But the commercial-free one's on later, so if you have people who don't want to commit 2 hours, they can commit an hour and a half. But really important information. And I don't know a lot about our guest, and I don't know how much he wants to tell us, but...
I want him to tell everything.
But no, I mean about himself. I don't know much about himself, about his own personal things, and he may not want to share that, but we do want to know that if you want to tell us, Frank. And we kind of want to know what made you start this project.
Okay. Well, I'd be happy to do that.
Start at the beginning.
As far as personal details about me, but all that I will say is I've got a 38 within reach.
You better.
I kind of didn't think there was probably a lot you wanted to put out about your personal life, because I would imagine this
is pretty wild.
Yeah, probably made you pretty unpopular.
Get really, you know, upset, particularly a book like mine, because it's illustrated. You know, it's got 25 illustrations, and they're not mocking or satirical type illustrations. They're just pulled from the literature, showing you know, things that Muhammad did, and they're not very flattering. You know, like mass murdering 700, 800, 900 Jews.
Yeah, all at the same time.
So yeah. So anyway, I thought there would be a really huge backlash because of it, but in fact, nothing in particular occurred. At least not yet. So
that's good.
Anyway. Yeah, so as far as the book goes, what got it going was 9/11. 9/11. Prior to that, you know, I really wasn't all that interested in the subject, and I just dismissed Islam as being, you know, not a religion, but some kind of a mental disease, and let it go at that. You know, but after 9/11, I started thinking about it. You know, what's behind all of this? Why do these people do what they do? And it took a long time to actually get around to doing this project, because, you know, I had to make a living, and it's an enormous subject. So I spent a number of years kind of dabbling in it and then acquiring books. You know, part of my early education in this had to do with finding out what I needed to learn. And it all centered on Muhammad, I mean, very quickly. So I went about, over the years, acquiring a library of about 500 books. About 150 of them have to do with Iran, and the rest have to do with Islam, a lot of them are secondary works, but I acquired all of the original literature of Islam that's available in English. And that includes the collections of traditions about Muhammad, the early biographies and histories and so forth. And what really kicked it off was the publication in 2011 of one of the key books of Islam, which is the book of Books of Raids and Battles of Muhammad by Waqidi. This is a huge volume. It's like 400,000 words. And it is by far the most detailed account anywhere of what he did. 70% of his biography has to do with basically atrocities that he committed against people. And this is that particular book, Waqidi's. It's all in there. So, and that was only available in English translation in 2011.
Wow!
As soon as I had that, I figured, well, it's time to get going on this.
Yeah,
so I allotted 3 years to the project.
Yeah, one of the things you'd mentioned in the book was the fact that so much of the history has not been translated even today.
That's true. There's still a lot other, documents that haven't been introduced yet in English. But all of the foundation work is there now. So that's really the key. You know, like the history of Ibn Ishaq, called The Life of Muhammad. That was translated, I think, in 1955, so it's been around for a while. Very difficult reading, though. Mainly, it's of interest to specialists.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think all of the major literature now is in translation. At least the Sunni side of it. A lot of what the Shias consider important is still, not in English yet. In any event, so I took 3 years to do this project, and it was day in, day out. You know, I went over a lot of this literature line by line. I mean, I scanned it into my computer. I broke everything down into multiple files and mini files and different categories. And what really struck me and started really getting my interest going were the characters. You know, the more I read, really three-dimensional characters. You could really understand them and almost kind of visualize them. Not just Muhammad, but all the people around him and his enemies. So, I did all of this compiling of information as I went along. You know, it's a biography, so, I start from A to go all the way to Z, birth through death. So that's what it took, 3 years, a lot of work.
Yeah, wow. And you did I thought you did a fantastic job when you talk about the characters in the book. There's a lot of names. They get kind of jumbled up after a while. But the main characters, the folks that had influence with him, the folks he surrounded himself with, really kept you glued to the book. It was
every
a great
time,
story.
I mean, Frank, really, every single time, it's like, where's Bill? Oh my gosh, he's in there reading that book again. It was like drugs. Where's Bill? He's reading the book. You know, we had 5 minutes before we had to go somewhere. Bill runs in there. He's got his book.
I think I read it in 5 days. It
was, I've never seen Bill read a book like that.
It was very compelling.
He was riveted. He's like, you're not going to believe it. This part right here.
Well, so much of it is actually
boring,
happening today.
No.
And that's what I think really makes it so riveting is when you read how a lot of these scriptures were written and why they were written and what's happening today as a result of these folks following these Quran scriptures, it makes total sense. So it was a very good read.
So for people who think, I might not want to read a boring book on Muhammad.
It's not boring.
It's not
the way
boring.
I wrote it.
No.
It's not, boring. It's not a novel, but it uses a lot of novelistic techniques. I use a lot of dialogue in there. And none of it's invented, by the way. All of the dialogue is extracted from the literature.
Oh, yeah, and you did a great job with referencing everything in the back of the book. If you want to doubt anything that's in the book, just go to the back.
Right, everything is there. It's 47 pages of double-column chapter notes.
Yes.
I deliberately put in there a lot of the extended quotations from the literature, in part, to give an idea, to support what's in the book, but also to give an idea of the nature of the literature. You can see, without having to acquire these books yourself, basically the tenor of them. So, that ended up being 47 pages long. That's a considerable amount of, that's 23,000 words, it turned out.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, when I first picked it up, it was like, oh, man, it's going to take me forever to read this book because it can't be that compelling. But I'll tell you what, you will go through it in a hurry.
Yeah, well, I wrote it that way to make it readable.
Good idea, because a lot of times let's face it, a lot of times it's not like that. We need to take a really quick break, but when we come back, now, Frank, tell me before we do this, how exactly do I pronounce your last name?
Burley.
It is Burley. Okay. I thought, well, maybe there's some trick thing. I shouldn't use his name incorrectly the whole time. We'd like to hear about Muhammad from the beginning, the part we never, ever hear about. So hang with us, folks. I think you're going to really, really learn a lot. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them? When they move into your neighborhood, they take over, but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body.
Going to be painful but factual. All right, we're here with Frank Burley, the author of It's All About Muhammad, and best read you're going to find. You can get that information on Amazon. I've put a link on the website at wethepeopleradio.us, and the archive of the show will be up for you this afternoon, so you can send it to other folks, because it's about time we all got smart on this whole thing. All right, so Frank, take us back to the beginning.
Okay. In the beginning, there was the Word. You want to go that far back? No.
That whole 7-day deal.
Well, Aaron just had a conversation the other day with somebody that didn't know, said he read all about Muhammad, and she popped two questions on him, one about who raised him, and the other one was his epilepsy. Didn't know either one of those. So, I mean, they're
those are important topics.
Huge.
They are.
Okay,
what was Muhammad the kid doing?
Pardon me?
Yeah, Muhammad the boy.
Yeah, well, here's the deal. He was born in Mecca, okay? And he was of the family that, the clan that controlled the temple. And back then, by the way, I don't use the word Kaaba. You'll notice in the book very much. Because Kaaba means cube, which is the shape that it has it today, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But back when he was born, the temple was just a rectangular wall of stone without a roof. And it was above the height of a man. And it had all kinds of idols inside and around it, okay? So he was born then into Mecca in 570 A.D., and his family was the family that had the temple duties, and a lot of the duties included feeding and providing water to pilgrims. The pilgrims would come from all over in order to do the rites of the temple and worship whatever idol they wanted. Excuse me, it was very, very eclectic. The Meccans were open to everything. They even had, at a later time, they even had an image of Mary and Jesus in the temple. So, very eclectic. Excuse me. So anyway, he was born, but the family was not that well off. Particularly, his father died either before he was born, just before he was born, or just after. his mother wasn't able to care for him. So within a week of him being born, he was given away to a Bedouin woman to raise, the nurse, basically, that's the way they put it. And she lived a 3 days ride, camel ride, away to the east of Mecca, near the town of Taif. So he didn't have any contact with his biological mother or his family practically until he was 5 years old. And this is all in the literature. You know, I'm only repeating what I found in the literature. And very early, his foster family determined that there was something kind of strange about him, because he had an episode of falling down and having this idea that some angels appeared to him and cut him open and washed him up and other weird things like that. Back then, epilepsy was called the falling sickness, because that's what happens when people have seizures. You know, they lose control of their muscles, sure, and they drop to the ground like a brick. And this happened to him when he was maybe 2 or 3 years old. So, and back then they thought it was devil possession. That's what epilepsy was, possession by the jinn. So they took the boy back to his mother. They wanted to get rid of him, give him back to the mother, but she talked them into keeping him longer. And they did for 2 more years, but then it started getting strange again with him. So they returned to him when he was 5 years old to his mother.
So now, at that point, he didn't even know his mother, and they were strangers. They were strangers.
You have to imagine that this would have been a very traumatic experience for him.
Sure.
Because his mother, as far as he knew, was the Bedouin woman, a woman named Halima. And so, you know, he was tied to her emotionally and to her to her husband and to the other children. So, you know, it must have been an extremely unsettling experience to be returned to a woman he didn't even know. But that's what happened. Then within a year, she died. Then he was turned over to his grandfather. His grandfather was the custodian of the temple, and he had something like 12 children. And he died two years after that. So you could see these series of, excuse me, of emotionally upsetting experiences, one after the other, that had a big role in shaping him psychologically. He was then taken into the home of one of his uncles, Abu Talib, who at one point inherited the duties of the father, of the grandfather, but then passed them off to another brother. He was not very well off. The way I read him from the literature was that he was a good-natured person and a lousy businessman, because he just wasn't able to cut deals that were favorable to him. Other people were sharper than him. So the family was not all that well off. And so Muhammad was raised in poverty, essentially. And at some point, he had to work as a shepherd. So he was out there with herds of goats on the mountainsides surrounding Mecca. And it's a very lowly occupation. That's like the low man on the totem pole when you're a shepherd. So it was humiliating. You can imagine how he felt being at the lowest rung of Meccan society. You know, shepherds weren't taken seriously. They were just people who took care of other people's goats. And so this was the situation. At one point, he went on a trade mission with his uncle, Abu Talib. And from the sound of it, they went up to the Gaza area and to Syria. I don't think it was called Syria back then. It was called Sham, the land of the sun. And then they returned to Mecca, and he got to experience a foreign culture at that point, because that was all Christian at the time. That whole region was Christianized. But they were also Arab, and they spoke the same language.
Frank, what year was this?
Well, he was born in 570, so this would have been like, the trip to Syria would have been like 12 years later.
Right.
So we're talking about 582 A.D.
Right. So the Christian religion was not brand new. I mean, it had been around a while.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it had been... it had spread, and then after Constantine converted to Christianity, which was, I think, the 4th century, then the entire empire became Christianized fairly quickly. Although, you know, there was still... The pagan cults still coexisted there with Christianity.
Right.
But it was, you know, steadily Christianizing, and at that time, it was almost entirely Christian.
Right. And that peninsula, a lot of that peninsula was the polytheist believers, and that's why they had all the different statues and gods and everything at their temples.
Right.
They had,
oh,
they had
and also, you know, it's
gods.
Interesting to note that much of the Hijaz, which is Western... the Wild West of Arabia, where Mecca and Medina are located, was Jewish. Medina, it used to be called Yathrib, and that's the name I prefer to use because that's what it was called back then. Yathrib was half Jewish. Mm-hmm. They had three major Jewish tribes. And then if you go further north, there are these different oases there. They were also Jewish, and they had been settled there for like 1,000 years. So they lived side by side with the polytheists. And to my knowledge, there were never any frictions or wars between tribes over religion there in that area. That only came later. But the Jewish presence was really strong. Really strong. And this is important to the story, too.
Sure, because that was probably his first big influence of an outside religion was on that caravan.
Yeah, and that was to Christianity, too. Mm-hmm. Now, Christianity did not have a big presence in the Hijaz. You did have people going through, and then when they had their annual fairs, you had missionaries who were proselytizing. You know, there was a, you know, like county fairs,
mm-hmm.
you know, today. Same kind of concept, except, you know, they sold slaves, bought and sold slaves, and did all kinds of strange stuff that wouldn't cut it today. But, yeah, they had, you know, missionaries there. And these fairs, by the way, were also noted for their poetry events. Poetry was really big in Arabia. It's a language that lends itself to poetry. And the Arabs really prided themselves on their compositions. So they would have these annual poetry contests. This is important because look at the Quran. This is supposed to be poetry, you know. So that's probably the reason that Muhammad chose, you know, to use verses, poetic verses, rather than just, you know, prose. So that was the background, you know, the religious background back then.
And I think that the why he formed or how he formed his whole religion is really set with that as a backdrop. The, you know, the poly... I don't know if people really understand the polytheist. Maybe when we come back, you could give kind of like a snapshot of what that means and how they practice, since we don't... Obviously, that's really foreign to us at this,
right.
at this point. We probably shouldn't gloss that over, I guess. Kind of important.
You want me to talk about it now, or are you going to go on break or what?
Let's do a really quick break, and then we'll come right back and do that part.
All right.
Okay, thanks. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be right back.
Waiting in the
Welcome back. We are here with Frank Burley, author of It's All About Muhammad, a biography of the world's most notorious prophet. I think that's the best title ever.
It is.
By the way.
We're talking about Muhammad right now as a boy, makes his first big trip out of Mecca and learns about Christianity or is exposed to Christianity and returns to Mecca. And at that time, Mecca was polytheist. And Frank, tell us about that and why that was such a big deal when he came in and tried to change it all.
Yeah, well, that's a good question, a really good question, and I'm glad you brought it up. The the Meccans were polytheists, and they had quite an array of gods and goddesses and so forth, which was in line with paganism in general, you know, throughout the Middle East and throughout everywhere, you know, even prior to Christianity in Rome, Greece, everywhere. You know, paganism, polytheism was the prevailing way of perceiving, you know, the universe, attributing the different things to gods and goddesses. The Meccans, for example, they had a god called Hubal, who was a moon god. And the temple of Mecca was initially a moon temple. But they also had an array of other, you know, deities that they worshipped. There was a trilogy of goddesses. The principal one was Alat, and then there was Alusa, and then Manat. And the first two, I've been able to sort of understand. Alat was kind of like a fertility goddess. And she was given preeminence in Taif, which was to the east of Mecca, about a three-day camel journey, which is where the region where Muhammad was raised in his early years. You know, it was an agricultural area in the mountains, and so it was natural for them to worship goddess of fertility. And she's got different names throughout, you know, the Levant. But it's basically the same idea, concept. And Alusa, on the other hand, which was a goddess very much favored by the Meccans, was a fertility goddess. And she represented the life force itself, whereas Alat was the reproductivity of nature, fecundity of nature. So this is what, you know, this is the type of belief, and it was very, there was nothing unusual about it for those days, except that, monotheism was spreading. Christianity was on the ascendance, and a lot of the Meccans were, or some of the Meccans, I should say, were starting to question the belief system. And there was a small group of four people. They were called the Seekers. And they formed a little group. And Muhammad's wife, Khadijah, was very much a part of that, because one of her cousins or one of her uncles was one of the Seekers. And so they made a lot of inquiries into Christianity, and in fact, three of them ended up converting to Christianity. And these people were within Muhammad's circle because of his marriage, and we should backtrack a little bit, if you'd like, about that.
Yeah, well, as a child, he came back to this society, and as he grew up, he was exposed to Judaism, Christianity, all their moon gods and all this.
And that wasn't considered bad, right? Was everybody allowed to be whatever they wanted?
Well, by and large, as long as nobody threatened the established order.
Sure.
One of that four was Zaid, and he was kind of a crusty old guy, an in-your-face contrarian. That's how I describe him in the book. And he would really get in people's faces, you know, and tell them that they were on the wrong religion. He was a big on Abraham. And he thought that Abraham had the right idea. There was just one God, and that was all he was ever going to be devoted to, one God. So Zaid was modeled his thinking, which was not very deep, on Abraham. So he was one of the influences on Muhammad. But I'm going astray here a little bit. But Muhammad, after his trip to the north and working as a shepherd and so forth, he became involved in the caravan trade to some extent because of his uncle Abu Talib was involved in the caravan trade, however modestly. So it stands to reason that Muhammad had a role in that.
And it was
not really clarified or gone into in any detail in the literature.
But at that time, Mecca was totally dependent on trade. They didn't. They weren't a seaport. I mean, they had to pretty much get by on these caravans. That's what supported their whole society, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely the truth. You know, it's an arid region, and they couldn't. There were no rivers. They didn't have any agriculture to speak of.
So keeping those trade routes,
they raised goats.
Yeah,
so they got milk and they got meat that way.
So they had to trade with everybody in order to get the goods they needed to flourish where they
otherwise
were.
Otherwise, it's milk and goat meat.
Yeah,
and buy food too. I mean, they had to buy wheat and they had to buy barley. They had to buy fruit. You know, so they had to import all that from other areas. And how did they pay for it? from their profits of their trade, yeah.
Right, and it was kind of important for them to get along with everybody so that they had these opportunities to trade with all these other cities.
Yeah, and the Meccan leaders were really clever, too, because they invited all these different tribes all over Arabia to bring their idols to the temple. And that kind of shored up, over time, the Meccan temple as being a center for pilgrimage Arabia. It wasn't the only place that people went to for pilgrimages, but because of that clever strategy, people tended to make Mecca part of their annual pilgrimage. That's not something new that started with Islam. That goes way back. You know, every year there was a pilgrimage period of 3 months. It was such a wild area, you know. The Hijaz means frontier, and it was a lawless, in a sense, a lawless area where there was constant tribal conflict, blood feuds, and so forth. But they had the wisdom to set aside 4 months of the year as sacred months, holy months, where violence was prohibited. So people could travel freely without having to worry about getting killed or whatever, or robbed. So 3 of those months were dedicated to the pilgrimage period. And during that time, they'd also go to their fairs and so forth. But then the terminus of that would be going to a particular, temple. So like I said, Mecca became very important in that circuit because of the fact that they imported all of these different tribal gods.
That was pretty good idea.
And they left the images outside the temple, and some were inside or even on the roof. So, that was really important to the development of Mecca as a commercial center.
So, as he grew up, he was involved in the trade to a certain extent. I mean, he wasn't a caravan owner or anything like that, but he worked for his uncle and grew up in the trade industry, so he understood kind of how things worked.
Yeah.
And then he
was also, by the way, before I forget, a kind of a layabout. Probably a little lazy, and maybe a dreamer because of his epilepsy, who knows, but he gets scolded by his uncle at one point, that he's got to start earning his keep and standing on his own feet. This is
right.
In the literature, I'm not making it up. So he arranges him to be the trade representative for a prominent woman in town, Khadijah, who was a businesswoman. And she had inherited her business from her father, and she knew the ins and outs of it, and she was very successful,
And he was how old?
An alpha woman.
Yeah, she was much older.
Huh? She was older, like 15 years older than him. So the uncle arranged for him to be her trade rep. And so he went to Syria on a trade mission and came back with some good money. And, you know, the literature is full of this nonsense of miracles and so forth. And so the way it's described in the book, when he comes back from the trade mission, you know, the camel caravan's coming into town. They pass in front of the temple. There's like an administrative building for the city right across from the temple. And people are milling around there, and all the camels are coming in. And he trots his camel up to Khadijah's house. And she and her companion see an angel hovering over him. So she was smitten, because the whole of Arabia was awash in talk about a prophet coming, the coming prophet. And here he was, coming towards her house, with an angel hovering over him. It's part of the nonsense that comes through in that literature. So anyway, the long and short of it is they end up getting married. And they have, you know, a bunch of children. If the literature is to be believed, they had six children. But there's some questions about that.
And
she may have had children from a prior marriage.
And he's how old at this point?
And then a second husband died. But she was a big influence on him. For one, she was wealthy. And so his status went from being, you know, near the bottom and to near the top, like overnight. So that was really important for him, an important development for him. And another important thing about that was that she was linked to this circuit of dissenters. So she may have been introduced to Christianity and may have learned something about it, although she was raised a polytheist too. But the key thing there is that she would have brought Muhammad into that circle of people who are questioning the validity of their polytheistic beliefs. So he was introduced by the time he was, maybe later, probably by the time he was 30 years old, this didn't happen overnight, to these kinds of people and to their ideas. So that's very important for his, you know, intellectual development.
Mm-hmm. Well, he, at that point, is just getting started. We need to take a really quick break here before the top of the hour, and we're going to come right back. We, just in case you're afraid we're not going to be able to finish the story about Muhammad's upbringing, we roped Frank into being on with us next week, too. So we're taking some time to do this background in detail, probably more detail than we'd have a chance to do if we were trying to cram it all into one program. But promise we won't leave you hanging. Anyway, we'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online. You've got all the information about the book and everything else at wethepeopleradio.us.
I'll keep my freedom. I'll keep my guns. Try to keep my money and my religion too. Try to keep on working. Try to keep on smiling. I will keep my Christian name, and y'all can keep the change.
Come on, people now. Smile on your brother. Everybody get together. Try to love one another right now.
Ah, the music. We swing, we swing wildly.
There's no reason we can't all just get along.
No, exactly. All right, we don't want to hog up any time.
Yeah, Frank.
Bill had questions, needs.
So when, he's back in Mecca now. He's learning about religion. When was he first, or when did he first believe he was spoken to by God and felt that he was the messenger?
Yeah, okay, good. Yeah, this could drag out being, you know, too much detail. I don't want to bore anybody with this. But before we get to that, I gotta, you know, inject something about epilepsy again. He had some more episodes of falling down that you can find in the literature, and of course they don't attribute it to epilepsy, but there's something divine about it for them. But once one of the important ones happened when he was part of the reconstruction crew of the temple. And this is an important development in Mecca because, like I said, the temple before then did not even have a roof. But it suffered some damage from a flash flood, and so they decided they needed to reconstruct it. And this would have been about 605 A.D., so Muhammad would have been 35 years old. And the way they used to work on construction projects like that, they would strip and use their waistcloth as a cushion to carry rocks on their shoulder so they don't, you know, cut or bruise their shoulder, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Muhammad, he was morbidly modest, and his uncle and other relatives pestered him to take off his clothes, you know, and do like everybody else. So he did it, and then he fell down. He fell down. He had a seizure.
And that's typically brought on by stress, is that right?
Well, that could be part of it, yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, of course, you know, the Muslims interpret it differently, but falling sickness is falling sickness. You suddenly fall down, you're frothing from the mouth. By God, you've got epilepsy. So, you know, he had episodes like that. So, lo and behold, when he was 40 years old, there was a cave up on one of the mountains there, just outside of town, that looked down on Mecca. If you got up to the top of it, you could look down, and there was the temple, and there was, you know, the town. So he had this little hideaway, and this is where his alleged communion with God happened. So where an angel supposedly appeared to him and told him to read some verses that he had, that the angel had. And so he did that. And in the literature, you know, he's really spooked. He's kind of like, you know, Scrooge after seeing Marley's ghost.
Mm-hmm.
He runs down the mountain, runs home, jumps into bed, just like Scrooge, you know, shaking. And his wife has to, you know, console him. And but she is kind of complicit in convincing him that it was a visitation from God through an angel, and that it meant that he was a prophet.
And he is how old at this point?
He was 40 years old at that point.
So
by
falling,
then he had already been introduced to, you know, Christianity and Christian ideas, and he
sure.
had had some Jewish context, too, of a different kind of, you know, not Jewish scholars, but people who were familiar with Jewish legends. So, starting from that point, like there was a three-year period where he came out with some verses. It wasn't a huge output, but during that time, he you know, began laying the foundation.
But he was illiterate, wasn't he?
Pardon me?
Wasn't he illiterate?
Well, I would say he's probably semi-literate. A lot of the people around him, like Khadija, could read, and she made sure that her children could read, learn to read.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was dyslexic.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, dyslexia, like 30% of epileptics are dyslexic. So.
I did not know that.
All right,
so
Frank,
probably,
we're going to,
you know, related to his epilepsy.
Right. We're going to take a hard break top of the hour here, but when we come back, let's pick it up where he's now been contacted by an angel, and he's the man. He's the next prophet.
That's right.
And we're gonna pick it up there.
This Sunday, it's all about Muhammad. Next Sunday, too, as a matter of fact. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be right back.